It's time to get your nerd on. This is CosmicPotatoNetwork.com. From the historic Cosmic Potato Studios, welcome to That Star Trek Podcast.
Hello, this is Captain Tilly. What the hell? Hold your horses!
This is your place for detailed analysis and speculation of all things Trek.
Besides, we've got the new uniforms.
And lovely uniforms they are, Captain.
Join us as we dive into the newest content coming available on CBS All Access, as well as retrospectives of the past series and films.
We're not doing that. I thought there were no bad ideas.
That's a lie.
That's a bad one.
Now, on with the show.
Discovery is out. Today will be her maiden voyage.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to That Star Trek Podcast, your unofficial guide to all things Trek. My name is Chantal. I will be your host. And tonight, we will be discussing episodes 3 and 4 of Star Trek Discovery's third season, which were titled People of Earth, written by Bo-Young Kim and Erica LaPolte, directed by Jonathan Frakes, and Forget Me Not, which was written by Alan B. McElroy, Chris Silvestri, and Anthony Marinville, and directed by Hanalei M. Culpepper. Joining me tonight in the historic Cosmic Potato Studios, we have Rick Tall. How's it going, sir?
Cake is eternal.
And we have Tom Tall. How's it going?
Going well. I don't have any pithy saying there.
And Scott Tall and John Tall should be here shortly. They're running a little behind. As we're recording this today, we found out that Joe Biden did win the election, and he was giving a speech about the time that we started recording. So John wanted to finish watching that before he came on, so they'll be here shortly. So, okay, this week we're a week behind because we took a break last week to record our Halloween party, which, by the way, you can still see on our YouTube channel, or you can listen to it over on the Cosmic Potato podcast feed. It was a lot of fun. We read pieces of the script of Night of the Living Dead, since it turned out to take a lot. Yeah, it took a lot longer than we thought it was, so we just kind of skipped around in it, and but we had a lot of fun anyway. And this week we're going to catch up. So I'm thinking we'll talk about these two episodes as though they were 1 2-hour episode, because they kind of ran into each other. The end of the first one kind of focused on Adira. Is her name Adira? And then almost the entire next episode was about her. So Rick, what did you think of these two episodes of Discovery?
I loved them. I spent a lot of time crying during both of them. This show has so found its footing. The direction and the writing in both of these episodes is exemplary. I was watching People of Earth today, because I haven't seen it since it aired, and so I wanted to catch up. I always watch the shows twice for the show anyway, but
yeah.
As I was watching People of Earth, I was amazed, because in Star Trek in general, and Discovery, not necessarily more than others, but there are a lot of times in Star Trek where I just have to go, all right, I'll let that go. Or I'll, okay. There was not a moment in People of Earth or in Forget Me Not that I had to exercise my willing suspension of disbelief muscles. They were both, I don't want to say perfect, but they were just consistent and tight and well done, and everybody was within character. And I loved every minute of both of the episodes.
Okay. Scott just joined us. How's it going, Scott?
It's going fine.
All right. Tom, what about you? What'd you think of these two?
I really enjoyed them both. I've only gotten to see Forget Me Not once. I haven't done my second rewatch on that. I think People of Earth was a stronger episode. Forget Me Not suffers the same issue that, I mean, you guys at least have talked about this before with this, and Scott and I talked about the same issue on concerning the series Upload, that they could have stretched the resolution for Forget Me Not with Adira making her connection to the symbiont and all those past lives. Could have stretched it out over several episodes and had some really significant plot development and had some really good story. And in a series that was doing a more traditional, like 26 episode run, I think they would have done that. But yeah, doing this 10 episode season, they really scrunched it into one episode. I kind of think that suffered a little bit, just because of the story opportunities it could have had, really working with Adira on that. That being said, overall, I think they did a great job. Like you said, the series is really hitting those characters. They're really getting the characterization in there. How many other Star Trek series really hit their stride in season 3? So it's, really good. Just those, that little nitpicky thing about story opportunities.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because as I was rewatching Forget Me Not tonight, I was thinking, although from a different standpoint, I think I was kind of relieved that it wrapped up quickly, because I was expecting, I still have that 26 episode season reflex of this is going to go on for 5 or 6 episodes, and they wrapped it up quickly. I didn't feel like it was overly quick, but I hadn't really considered that viewpoint of it could feel awfully fast if you would like to see it drawn out more, but explored more. I'm on the record as saying I'm not a fan of the 10-episode season anyway, but then I never can get enough Star Trek. So, 26 episodes isn't necessarily enough for me either. So
I suppose the response to that is they are going to have those same opportunities with the reveal that they showed at the very end with drawing a blank on the name.
Gray.
Boba Fett. Wrong series.
Yeah.
I like both of these episodes. I thought that, both of them were better than episode 2, but I like having everybody back together. Some of the things they did with the characters I really enjoyed. If I had anything bad to say, I'll get into it as we go through the episode. But with the first one, I felt that the task that Discovery accomplished, I feel like it came off that they got that accomplished a little too easily. I mean, the first thing that they tried to do, it worked, and then everybody's happily ever after.
Star Trek Discovery, a series of things going really well.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And then I did have a problem with the second one. I mean, I enjoyed the episode. I'll wait until we get to that point in the episode before I start talking about what I didn't like. Scott, what about you? What'd you think?
Of the both of them, I certainly favor Forget Me Not over People of Earth. They're both Discovery, and it's a new season with a new direction and a new time frame, and I'm really digging it. I think that the jump to the, where are we at now? Is it the 33rd century, 34th? What century are we talking about?
33rd.
33rd. I'm liking that they've moved to this new century. It gives them a lot of freedoms, and we haven't had a whole lot of time for them to take advantage of it, but what they've done so far, I've been a fan of. For People of Earth, I had an array of minor issues with it. Nothing that is really huge. It didn't really set me on fire. I've heard some people make this criticism, and I think I definitely share it, which is by the end of the episode, they were trying to make it clear that Michael, well, she's a different person now. We don't know if she's going to be able to blend in with the, wait a minute, how are you so different? And not to say she can't be different, but they haven't really taken their time to, don't whine at me. Don't, no, hush. Meow. They didn't really take a whole lot of time to show us how she's different, but they spent a lot of time telling us that she's different, and that has to be good enough. If they want us to believe that she's different, then, you know, give it two or three episodes to show us that she's different, and don't just announce it like it's a big change that we should just automatically be on board with. Forget Me Not, fantastic episode.
Yeah,
I just loved it, and I assume that we're gonna break down and discuss each of the episodes in a bit more detail, so I'll talk about the things I liked when we get there. But I think John was the one that said this on Facebook that it was his favorite episode so far of the season, and I'm right there with him. Forget Me Not was incredible.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about every aspect of both of these episodes, or else we'll be talking for 3 hours. But we do want to hit the highlights. But I wanted to ask you guys, and it struck me as I was watching Forget Me Not. We're in a brand new century. We're in a time period that's never been seen in Star Trek before. Do you feel like the Spore Drive takes some of the exploration out of Star Trek? Because a lot of storylines, and if you think about it, like the original series and the Next Generation, a lot of stuff that they ran into going somewhere else. We're on our way to this place, and we ran into this. And with the Spore Drive, they don't have to do that. So they said, let's go to Trill. They're at Trill. You know? And I understand that a lot of it, like Tom was saying, a lot of it has to do with the fact that they're only doing 10 or 12 episodes and not 26. So they don't have time to put in episodes where they meet a new alien or something like that. But it seems like being in a period that you've never done before on screen, it would be right for some storylines of just, we ran into this new thing on the way to this other place.
Yeah, they don't have time for that right now.
Yeah.
They don't have time for any exploration stuff. They got a job to do. They got a Federation to find. They got a Starfleet to rebuild. They're not going to make the mistake that Janeway did, which is, okay, our number one mission is to get home. Now we're going to go about that as slowly as effing possible.
Right.
And stop as often as we can. They're,
that's if, the Starfleet if, way.
Yeah, that's the Starfleet way. The roundabout way.
The Janeway initiative.
Right. If Discovery makes Discovery their mission, huh? See what I did there? Yeah. If they make that their primary mission again, then yeah, the Spore Drive will get in the way of it, because if you go from point A to point B, you miss everything that's on the line in between. But the line in between is not what they're focused on right now, so I'm okay with them just immediately getting from one place to another. What I don't like about the use of the Spore Drive is, I've never been able to pin down, okay, is it okay to use it? Is it safe to use it? Is it dangerous to use it? Does it put the mycelial network at risk? Are they going to run out of spores? They had to make new spores that one time. Haven't they run out again already? Doesn't this put an undue tax on Stamets, or is that just not a plot point anymore because we don't need it to be hard for him? It's like in season 3, they decided that the Spore Drive itself, its use, the mechanics of it, and whether or not anyone else in the Quadrant notices this ship that can just blink in and out of existence at will. Mm-hmm. None of that is important anymore, so now it's just their default method of travel is just spore jumps. And if that's the new baseline that they're setting for us, if that's the new reality, then I'm okay with it. But they haven't really said anything about it. It just has, in the past 4 episodes, become the way they get places.
Yeah.
We also don't know if they can use their warp engines. you know, we don't know yet if the burn was a one-time thing or if it's a, you go to warp, your ship blows up. They've been kind of vague about this because they're like, on the one hand, we can't use warp engines. On the other hand, book clearly used warp engines. So Stamets said, this burn thing is bullshit. they said what we've all been saying since the get-go. How the hell can this happen to all the lithium everywhere? So even the show is acknowledging that there's something we don't know yet.
I think the spore drive is one, it's kind of leveling the playing field for Discovery. I mean, a 1,000-year-old ship, you know, they've got to have something that keeps them in the game. And it's protecting that dilithium resource. You know, it's kind of shielding them, but because they have to have their warp drive offline to use it. So it's both their protection against, you know, other people attacking them and, you know, raiding them for their dilithium and just keeping them where they can actually interact, because I mean, otherwise that ship should be just completely obsolete.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk a little bit about, because at the beginning of this episode, we get a voiceover from Michael talking about that, you know, that she's become what she call herself, a courier. Yeah, courier. And she's but she's still looking for Discovery and all that. But then she kind of talks about what happened with the burn. She said all the lithium went inert, and any ship with an active warp core detonated. But then they showed a bunch of ships explode. Those ships were not at warp. They were just sitting
there. You don't have to be at warp for your reactor to be online.
Yeah, that's right. What I'm saying.
That's the primary power source for all warp-capable ships.
Yeah, it was an active warp core. What that makes me think is, from what she said, any ship within... it caused the dilithium to go inert, so an active warp core breached, which tells me with the dilithium going inert, it could no longer control the matter-antimatter reaction. So every ship exploded because their antimatter reaction went crazy with nothing to control it. And that's what caused all the explosion. It wasn't that the dilithium exploded. It's the dilithium stopped doing its job, which is to stop the warp core from exploding all the time. Yeah,
that was my point, was that, like Rick said, we don't know if Discovery can go to warp, but if they have a warp core, they don't necessarily have to go to warp to explode if this burn thing happens again. So, which we know that the couriers have been collecting dilithium. We don't really know what they've done with that dilithium. We don't know if they've put that in ships and they're using it.
Yeah, they've been using it.
Okay,
and
so...
The burn happened, and it made all that dilithium go inert, but not all the dilithium, and the dilithium that is still usable. The ships are using it to travel. It's just a lot harder to get their hands on it, so it's tougher to travel at warp. And they have explored and found a few alternate ways to travel that fast, but it seems that dilithium is still the fallback.
And that's the other thing that, you know, I've been complaining about since the beginning of this season, is they seem to be treating dilithium as fuel as opposed to as something that controls the reaction of the fuel.
Yeah.
And I'm still waiting for that to be explained, and hopefully it will be.
It was a consumable resource. It always has been. You know, there was always, remember when in Relics, Scotty comes back and starts and finds out that they've learned to recrystallize dilithium.
Mm.
And there's been other references that, even though it's not a fuel, it's still something that does degrade or decrystallize or...
True. You're absolutely right. But it's not like, here's 3 ounces of dilithium that'll get you from here to Alpha Centauri, and then you're going to need more.
True.
And that's kind of what they were doing with it in episode one.
Yeah, and then by the next generation time, they had figured out a way to recrystallize the dilithium. So, yeah.
Well, actually, it was in Star Trek 4.
Well, it's still inside the articulation frame. No, Mr. Scott, please.
Rick started to mention in Star Trek 4, and remember, that's when he said you couldn't recrystallize dilithium.
Mm-hmm. Scotty went, hold my beer.
That's true. Then he goes and finds a way to do it.
I couldn't even do that in the 23rd century.
Yeah.
I suspect that when they came up with the idea for how are we going to destroy the Federation in the 33rd century, let's say that all the dilithium goes. Well, how is that going to work as far as the physics of this universe that we've created? I'm pretty sure that some of the writers and story breakers essentially decided, well, we haven't really fleshed this out 100% in the past, so we're going to kind of make it up in a way that serves our story needs, and that'll just be the canon. And there might be, there's going to be some details that have been mentioned in years past that might go against the story that they're coming up with, but this is how Star Trek works. You try to stay close to established canon, but if you have to retcon some stuff and make some changes in order for the story you're writing to work, the story that you're writing now takes precedence over the stories that have been written in the past, especially since in the past they probably weren't putting as much thought into it as they are now. And they could even say that in Deep Space Nine. When they were making TOS, they weren't thinking about the story as much as we are, so our story takes precedence. It's the same thing now.
Yeah.
And I'm totally cool with that. And you know, and I've said this before. All I need is, you know, one sentence in the intervening 930 years, our engine efficiency has become, you know, 250,000% more efficient, but it also eats the shit out of dilithium while we're doing it.
Yeah.
That's all I need to hear.
Yeah, two words, soft reboot.
Right. And I do like what Tom had to say a minute ago about the reliance on the spore drive being a good way to counteract the obsolescence of the ship, considering its age. Since we learned in All Good Things that Warp 13 was going to be, you know, a steady jog for starships in the near future. When the refit Enterprise D shows up with its three nacelles traveling at warp 13, but where did that go?
That was Q f***ing around. None of the stuff in the future in All Good Thing. I'm sorry, I'm being real bad about my mouth. And it, not, I apologize.
Yeah, because in Voyager, when they reached warp 10, they turned into slugs. And
I keep hearing this argument, and I'm not coming down on you for it, but a lot, you know, everyone's like,
hey, go ahead and come down. I was making a joke more than anything else. So go okay.
In All Good Things, people are like, in All Good Things, we saw this, this, and this, and this. And the, you know, and even in the episode, they were like, well, that was a maybe future, and we've already changed some of it. So
yeah,
that was just Q being Q.
Yeah.
So, you know, the whole Warp 13 thing, I think, is, was just Q being silly.
So your contention is that anything that we saw that was taking place in the future of the present day Picard as we knew him, of season 7 Picard,
mm-hmm.
You maintain that everything that took place in his future was a construct from Q,
and
not necessarily an actual look into the actual future.
I maintain that everything that we saw in Picard's future in All Good Things potentially was Q's fabrication.
Potentially. Whenever you notice, a big word, potentially. It means a lot.
Whenever you notice something like that, a wizard did it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not saying it definitely is. I'm just saying that there is, and you're not doing that. I know you're chain yanking, but there is this subset of fans who we all know, who are slavishly, there's, you know, the canonistas, and goddamn it, I used to be one. You know, I have, if I can learn to unclench about canon, anybody can. But the whole All Good Things, everything from, you know, Picard being an old man in the vineyard, and Data with the streak in his hair, and now, we have had confirmation about the Iremotic syndrome, although for some reason they wouldn't say it. I don't know why.
It has to be 25% different, Rick. You know this.
It probably had something to do with not. It probably had something to do with not wanting to pay whoever wrote All Good Things.
I, you know,
like the Paris Locarno thing.
Yeah, neither Roddenberry nor Berman are involved in Star Trek anymore, so I doubt.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, I'm not saying that the stuff in All Good Things can't happen. I'm just saying that it doesn't have to happen,
mm-hmm.
because that was Q's. That was Q, and all bets are off with Q.
Tilly is talking to Michael, and she basically lets her know that she knows that she kind of gave up on ever seeing them again. She calls it, she let them go, which Michael said the same thing in her voiceover, that she let them go. So
that conversation was kind of confusing, hard to follow, because it seemed like Tilly was chastising Michael, but then they both laughed about it. So I really
no, I think sure Tilly was just telling her that she knows, but I think she was also telling her that she understood. She understood why, because she didn't know if she was ever going to see him again, and how much do you owe somebody that you don't know if you're ever going to see him again? How long do you owe them sitting there looking for him? You know, are you not supposed to ever do anything with your life again until they get there? You know, so I think that's what she was telling her, that she knew that it happened and she was okay with it.
I took it more as forgiveness rather than blaming her.
Yeah. Mm. But anyway, like I said, Michael acts like she's been away from him for like 10 years. It's been 12 months, you know, yeah. And I know Ricky said the same thing last week, but I don't know why they chose for it to be a year, because they could have very easily have said other than suddenly having to make Michael up to look 10 years older or something like that, which they could have done with just a little bit of gray in her hair or something like that, you know? But anyway, they get to Earth, and they're greeted by a bunch of force fields, because Earth is very defensive these days, because people are always trying to steal me Lucky Charms. I mean, my dilithium. People are always showing up.
Why does Earth have a buttload of dilithium? Ships are built on Mars. Okay. I know. It's 900 years in the future, so maybe things are different. But that kind of was a thought that was like, ships aren't built on Earth. The shipyards are on Mars, or at least they were, so why would Earth be being raided for its dilithium?
I think it's probably a combination of two things. One, they might not have had the shipyards on Earth. Now, in the intervening centuries, they might have moved them to Earth or Earth orbit. But even if they didn't, Utopia Planitia is not that far.
We don't know for sure that Utopia Planitia was ever rebuilt after that incident.
Also true. No, they might have decided, you know what, Mercury is the place to be. I don't know. But regardless, if the shipyards were close, then they could have brought it to Earth from there. Or, and I think this is more likely, after the burn, what few Federation ships were left, where would they go?
Yeah.
They're going to run home as quickly as possible. So all the ships that end up flocking back to Earth, because now literally everything has changed, they all come back to Earth. I'm sure the many of the ships were decommissioned, and their dilithium stores were probably transported down to Earth and held there. So Earth probably, my suspicion is that Earth has so much dilithium because most of Starfleet's dilithium stores came back home, and now they're sitting on it.
Mm. Or they just were collecting it and stockpiling it themselves. You know, it's a valuable resource. We're going to go out, find some, and bring it back as best we can.
And sit on it and then do nothing with it. That seems kind of silly. But again, in situations like this, it's not like Starfleet and the Federation have a perfect track record for decision making.
True. Yeah. True. And then we hear about the baddie of the week, which is Wynn, and he's supposed to be a pirate, and he's after the dilithium or whatever. And yeah, and so this is what I was kind of talking about earlier. It seemed like this happened very easily. Michael and Book did their little switcheroo Scooby-Doo act where they pretended like they were given the dilithium over, and then they captured them and took them back to the ship, and they said, "Now you guys talk," and then everything worked out. And it seemed very easy. Which I know they got to wrap it up and get this plot point over with, so they can move on to something else.
Have you ever seen Voyager? That was their hallmark.
Yeah.
It was a problem that wasn't a problem, definitely. Once you figure out, okay, what are the circumstances of this problem? Okay, well, how about you do the obvious thing? Oh, you know, we never tried that. Obviously not. Once they try it, then everything's fine.
I don't know. It came across to me as being like some real classic Trek. I mean, how many times did you have Kirk or Picard or Janeway or, you know, any of them as the mediator to, you know, hey, you know, actually take a look, you know, talk to each other. And, you know, yeah. Earth had been terrorized by Black Manta there. And that's really what I thought the first time I saw him is.
In a nice surprise appearance by Chris Heyerdahl, and I always love seeing him show up in my sci-fi.
What is he from? I know people were freaking out, and I've never seen him in anything.
Yes, you have.
I have.
He was Todd the Wraith in Stargate Atlantis, and he also made a few other guest appearances on other Stargate series.
I never saw his face.
Okay, so I never saw him before.
he showed his face very clearly in an episode of SG-1, which the title of which I can't remember. But he appeared on that in one episode. But yes, his turn as Todd the Wraith. Okay, you didn't see his face quite so well, but he did so good.
Yeah, I remember Todd the Wraith now. But you know, it's been 20 years since I saw it. But I think there was something else people have seen him in more recently. Can I just say, before we go any further, that Michael and Book, you could fucking light. Oh God damn it! Sorry. I'm sorry. I'm really being bad tonight. You could light fires with those two just standing next to each other.
Yeah.
The chemistry between those two is incredible. And I know I've heard actors talk about that, you know, chemistry is just part of the craft. But there's chemistry where, yeah, we work together well and we're reading the lines and you know, and then there is just freaking embers. There's like this, if this wasn't shot digitally, the celluloid would be melting. It's just incredible the way these two play off of each other. It's so much fun to watch.
Yeah, I agree with you.
They're pretty.
Pretty people.
I got a question before we get too far off. The Earth, when they get there, they were talking to, and I'm sorry, I'm looking at another screen where I looked up Memory Alpha, United Earth Defense Force. Was that that wasn't the same name as from Enterprise, was it? Like they didn't do a callback to pre-Federation, pre-Starfleet?
No, they didn't. It wasn't a defense force back then.
It was just United Earth.
Yeah, I think it was United Earth Government, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, I think a lot of the storyline with the people from Earth and the people from Titan, all of that was just because we need to get a character like Captain Ndoya. Wasn't that her name? Ndoya, something like that.
Ndoya.
Yeah, Ndoya. Okay. And we need to get her in there, and we need to get some exposition from her, and we need to make it make sense that she comes on and not make it quite as easy for Discovery crew. So let's put a little bit of something else in there. But she tells them that the admiral that they're looking for, which was the admiral that put out the communication that we skipped over and didn't even speak about at the beginning, Michael had a communication from a admiral Senatal from 12 years before that was basically calling out to anybody related to the Federation to come to Earth. And when they get there, they find out that the Federation is not on Earth. Starfleet is not on Earth. And Senatal died 2 years ago on a mission. But this new character, Adira, that we meet, that's part of the group that's doing inspections throughout the ship, played by Blue Del Barrio,
who is absolutely freaking amazing.
Yeah, she was great, and I'm going to talk about her here in just a minute. She tells Stamets that she knows Senatal, and she can help them find him. So the captain tells Saru, you know, at the end of their mission and everything, that she can go with them, and she tells them that, yeah, I know Senatol. I am Senatol. Saru has to go do a little bit of research with the spore data to find out who the Trill are.
Sphere data.
Sphere data, excuse me. What did I call it? The Sphere data? Excuse me.
Spore data.
The Spore data, okay.
Spore drive, Sphere data.
Yeah, the Sphere data.
I'm glad they brought the Sphere data in there, though.
Yeah.
I'm glad they covered that potential break and can't, you know, the retcon, because Discovery's crew wouldn't know anything about Trill.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's what I was about to say. They didn't know anything about the Trill people until the episode that where Commander Riker had to take on a Trill symbiote.
Mm-hmm. Now, Earth, I've heard this pointed out already. Earth was aware of the existence of Trill because Emini Dax attended a gymnastics competition on Earth, and that's when she slept with McCoy when he was in med school. So there was some type of awareness and, you know, acquaintance between Earth and Trill, but
they didn't know anything about the symbiotes and all that.
Probably not enough to know anything about symbiotes. That wasn't discovered until the TNG episode with Odan. And they didn't really specify if it was something that Trill was trying to keep under wraps and that's when the secret was uncovered, or if they just never got around to mentioning it because they weren't actually necessarily a part of the Federation. They were just, you know, a friendly planet to the Federation.
I got one more thing I want to talk about before we move into the next episode. There was a lot of stuff that came out after this episode about Blue Del Barrio and, you know, Adira and stuff, because it came out before the show started that there was going to be a non-binary character. And then they had this episode and she was referred to as she a lot. And I think people are just confused as to what non-binary means. Wait a minute. Let me bring John into the stream. There's John. The thing is, and I saw an interview with her talking about it. You can't make assumptions about this character yet, because she's not. She has not. For one thing, she hasn't come out to the crew, so they don't even know anything about her non-binary status and everything. She refers to herself as she and her, and it's like the rule that I go by. You're allowed to call yourself whatever you want. She can still be non-binary and call herself she if that's what she wants to do.
They don't refer to themselves at all in the episode by a pronoun.
No.
And forget me not. Adira refers to herself as she or her and stuff.
Yeah,
and others call her she, and I don't think the writers
others
would do that.
They don't.
Yeah, no. but if that was going to be a point, the writers wouldn't have them call her she.
Yeah, it will be it yeah. I'm just saying that the actor Blue is non-binary and goes by and uses they them,
and the character is non-binary as well. And they said that in the interview. It's just that this character is kind of mirroring Blue's story, her real story, and that she hasn't come out yet. When she comes out, her pronouns may change. We don't know. So don't take the first time that you see the character on the episode and just assume that you know everything and start and go online and just, they're calling her she. You know, they're not following.
One episode cannot be enough to establish something, especially something like that, which is it's an important subject for a lot of viewers, and it's also a brand new subject for Star Trek. And you can't say, oh, well, they didn't immediately within the first 10 minutes get it right with this character. Well, then they fail miserably and entirely. No, give them some time. And also stop for a moment and consider the fact that when you have a host and a symbiont who are joined, in essence, that is, you know, by default, a non-binary character, because now that they are joined, all the past experiences of the symbiont are woven into the personality. So they are both male and female based on their experiences and their memories.
that might be the non-binary that they're talking about with this character. I don't know, because, you know, like we said, we've only had two episodes with this person and only one where it's been, you know, actually explored that they are a joined Trill. So we'll give them a minute to figure that out.
Yeah, my thing is that there's not an LGBTQ handbook with a bunch of rules that have to be followed. Things like the pronouns and stuff like that, it's person to person. So just because a person says, if I'm non-binary, but then your pronoun is still she, her, or whatever, there's no rules. They can be whatever they want to be.
Now, I just looked them up because they're playing 16 years old. But the blue is 26 or 23 or 24.
Yeah.
There's some debate on what their actual birthday is, but they're either born in 96 or 97, according to Wikipedia. But still, for such a young person to have that much depth in their performance is just incredible. I was so blown away, especially the second time I watched through these episodes, how amazing their performance is, how natural their performance is.
Adira's story continues in the next episode in Forget Me Not. And a lot of the episode is about her. And,
we just go on to the next episode?
Yeah, we're going into the next episode.
Just got here. I know. All right. So let me zoom through my notes.
Okay.
Did anyone, when Sean introduced you, did anyone say cake is eternal?
Yes, Rick did.
Okay. Did anyone say?
I miss the introductions. So
they started. I had a backup in case Scott was here because I know he'd say it.
Did anyone say, okay, we get it. You're smart. Everyone here is smart.
No.
Okay. Did anyone say, okay, I'm sober. Maybe it'll work this time.
No.
I wish I had. My backup was one eye. We're not pirates.
Nice. Okay. See the look on Book's face when he beams aboard, like logging into dial up. He's just, why am I not here yet? That was great. Weird that Stamets was the one to talk to Adira instead of Tilly, or maybe both of them. I can see both of them, but Stamets being like the one to reach out to a 16-year-old kid and like getting her to trust him. It's not completely out of character. Like, I get it, but it seems like Tilly would have been a better choice.
Out of character for him to be that nice to her. Because Stamets is not usually that nice.
Yeah. Well, especially since they've been setting up that douchebag Stamets is back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So much better without the shaky cam.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what this... Two hotties. Oh, okay. So,
two hotties. I really want to know now.
I was like, what does this note mean? All right, so this is in reference to when Giorgio, you know, asks Book about their relationship, about his and Michael's relationship. And he's like, you know, nothing ever. And I wrote, two hotties in deathly situations and the never nothing. I think Book's heart belongs to another. Grudge is a queen, and she and Book are in love. I realize they probably won't go there, but it'd be interesting, right?
Actually, I think it was Michael who was like, no. He was like,
well, I think
now, no.
I think both of them. I think they both flirt very well, and they both know it probably wouldn't be the best decision. I'm not calling it headcanon. I'm calling it a hope. Although I don't think they're going to do it. But if you're really about breaking down boundaries and you're really about it's the person inside and the body doesn't matter so much, and he can talk to animals. We know this.
Okay. I do not want to even think about... No.
I'm just saying. Love transcends the physical.
No bestiality. They don't have to have it, please.
They don't have
ISIS.
I don't think they're going to, but I'm saying it is the logical conclusion, especially this far in the future. And again, I'm not look, I don't mean they are in love like they're making love. I mean, they're in love.
Okay.
If the message is, you know, it's about the who, not about the what. You can't tell me if they can have a heart to heart conversation and they can see into each other's souls because he can talk to what we see as animals. I'm just saying. All right.
I can get this very uncomfortable for Scott.
I personally think that Book looks at, what's the cat's name again?
Grudge. This is Xena, and she needs comfort from me because she's disturbed by what John is saying.
I think
she's like, finally, this is my chance.
Yeah.
Someone understands.
I think their relationship is more like father daughter than where you're going.
I would just like to point out, for once, the most disturbing concept brought up on the show did not come from me.
I would just like to point out the show is only like a third way over. So, all right,
We'll call it half.
I want to do a throwback. Throwback to original series. Remember Gary Seven and Isis? Maybe that's what we're looking at with Grudge, that shape shifting cat.
I don't think she's. I think if she were a shapeshifter, Michael would know at this point because they've been together for a year. Now it's possible. Ooh, what if she's a changeling?
This is not getting better.
Again, with the Rebel Burnham, this is in reference to her just taking off and doing her plan without. If she had given Saru the smallest heads up of, hey, I've got a plan, stall him, that's all he would have needed, instead of him having to figure it out and endanger everyone on the ship. Again, with the Rebel Burnham, I think the thing I appreciate most about this episode is also the thing I liked the least. Her backsliding into bad habits, namely not telling Saru her plan. It would have taken 2 seconds for her to say, I have a plan, cover me. That would have been enough, and it wouldn't have strained their trust. I say I love and hate it because on one level, it's like, what about growth and character development in terms of the show? But on the other hand, that's how real people are. Just because you move beyond some bad behavior doesn't mean you never have a relapse or never exhibit that behavior again, especially if your circumstances have changed, like being, you know, effectively alone for a year. And that old behavior is actually beneficial, like being, you know, a badass space pirate. Nice hesitation by Detmer when Saru tells her to do something that she's like, I don't want to move the ship, sir. Nice hesitation by Detmer. She questions it, but she still follows orders. Helpless is a shitty feeling. All right, that was the first one. All right.
Got one other thing I want to say before we move on.
All right.
Doug freaking Jones has, in both of these episodes, was, I mean, we've always loved Doug Jones as Saru. He's great, but his empathy has just gone through the roof in these two episodes.
And Saru has finally taken officially become captain of the, not acting captain, but actual captain of Discovery now. And
yeah, but just not even just that. Just
yeah.
Jones' performance has been
he's great. Yeah, yeah, I mean, he's one of my favorite characters to watch and to listen to. The way he delivers his lines, and it's always great. He's always great.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Hey, wait, Sean. I'm sorry. I figured out the burn. I have figured out what the burn is.
Okay.
Okay. And John triggered it when he was talking about the Rebel Burnham. We're looking at a Voyager-Viger situation. It's got to be Michael's mom. She destroyed the universe and went from Burnham. It's been shortened over time to Burn.
I'm not going to be very happy if it turns out that Michael or her mother caused the burn. Because at that point, I'm just like, you know what? Take anybody in the galaxy named Burnham and just lock them up somewhere because they just keep messing stuff up.
Discovery, you know, the writers and the producers there, just, you know, send the royalty checks my way. I've seen through your madness.
All right, so we.
I gotta ask the two Madisons here. Did like your parents at dinner every night require you to extrapolate on what you watched the night before?
You know, I'm certain if you ask either one of them, they would be at a complete loss to figure out how we got to be the way we are.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's like, you both do this stuff.
We start Forget Me Not by Adira is getting, I don't know, a scan, an X-ray, whatever. They say that she calls it a squid. I don't think I've ever heard the symbiote referred to as a squid before. I've heard slug and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But
she doesn't have other trill to inspire her to come up with.
And maybe squids are different in the future.
Yeah.
Think about that.
She says that the symbiote is wrapped around her heart and it's connected to every major system in her body. So, you know, they're completely entwined. She says that it's protecting her because Saru kind of, he's kind of worried about it wrapping around her heart. But of course, he's from the 23rd century. He's never seen this before. She's not just having trouble accessing Tal's memories. She's having trouble accessing her own memories. She doesn't even remember how she got joined in the first place. She just knows she woke up and it had happened. So Michael goes with her to Trill. And the other Trill, the council or whatever that they appear in front of, they see her as an aberration. And they debate whether or not they should forcefully take Tal out of her, which would possibly kill her. Would probably kill her.
Not possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah. As established in, you know, six centuries prior, no, I'm sorry, 9 centuries prior, it would be deadly. In the 33rd century, maybe you would just be really rude and uncomfortable. But
the way Zine responds, it's pretty clear it would kill her.
Yeah, as far as we the viewers know, that's a death sentence, and also, you know, rude.
Right.
And can I say, for a dude who's probably close to my age, Z is freaking ripped. Those guns were amazing.
Yeah, he was like first contact Picard there.
Yeah.
So they basically they tell her that she needs to leave and not come back. But that member of the council that's escorting them back to their shuttle is instead escorting them to the caves where he's going to take the slug out of her anyway, and they get rescued by. What'd you say his name was? The
Z.
Z.
So, Guardian Z.
Yeah, XI.
They get rescued by him.
I don't know about rescued. They get found. Michael had already
he takes them to the cave so that she can commune with her former hosts and all that kind of stuff. But his thinking is that she could possibly be the future of their race because the burn, they lost a lot of potential hosts. Yeah, Burnham. During the Burnham, they lost a lot of potential hosts. So they have a lot of symbiotes that they can't join to anybody because they don't have enough viable hosts to.
Well, one thing I enjoyed about this episode, is that the Trill are clearly still operating under the fiction that there are far fewer Trill that can combine with hosts than is factual. Because that's one of the things that DS9 established was that more than 50% of the Trill population are perfectly capable of joining with the symbionts. But for various political reasons, that fact wasn't revealed.
I like that too, Rick.
Yeah.
That lie was maintained throughout history and is ultimately leading to their destruction.
Brandon's got a good question here, and it's off the subject, but when Discovery meets up with the Federation, if they command them to turn over Discovery, do they do it or do they fight?
We'll find out next week, I think.
I guess.
I think that the Federation will co-opt Discovery. Because they already serve the Federation, so why fight over it when they already...
Depends on what the Federation's turned into, because if the Federation has turned into a bunch of badmirals, you know, then Saru's not going to allow them to join that.
Right. They will hear Starfleet's request or order to turn over Discovery, and as the crew of Discovery tends to do on their own show, they will make a moral judgment based on their perspective, and then they will act according to what they think is right, which is why you have Burnham and the rest of the crew of Discovery at the end of season one deciding, you know what, the Federation decided to commit a genocide against the Klingons, but we don't think that's right, so we're going to change... We're going to change the Federation's decision just on our own. Now, was it the right thing to do? Of course it was, because, you know, you shouldn't genocide. That's wrong. You don't do that. But
can I wear that shirt from you, Scott? You shouldn't genocide.
You don't do that. You
shouldn't,
okay?
You shouldn't genocide. Genocide not is cool. Bad.
Genocide is bad. Genocide, not cool.
I think that's actually on my daughter's box of Fruit Loops. It's like, don't run into traffic. Don't genocide.
Don't
eat your parents.
If it's on the Fruit Loops, just follow my nose. Genocide is bad.
Yeah, Brandon says, I mean, Picard always made that moral choice in TNG, too.
I think I brought this up before on the show, but like when I was in the service, when we were learning about the Uniform Code of Military Justice, there is literally a directive. I don't know if it's a specific order. It probably is. I don't remember anymore.
Was it the first one?
It's not
general,
the prime directive.
General order number one, don't genocide.
But no. You know, it's drilled into you from the very get-go that you are obligated to disobey an illegal order. I was just following orders is not an acceptable excuse for committing atrocities.
Only in the movies. Absolutely.
Well,
all right. So I wanted to talk about when they got to the they get to the caves, and Adira gets into the pool, which we've seen these caves before. This was on Deep Space Nine.
They didn't have as many LEDs in them as they did.
Yeah,
this time.
The symbiotes live in these pools of water, and you can get into them, and you can commune with them, and stuff like that. So she got in there, and her eyes rolled back in her head, and her eyes just vanished. And she, so she goes into like a communion with them, where it's almost like whenever Sisko went to talk to the prophets, you know, she's off in another land. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, also, didn't Dax, when she wanted to talk to her former host, didn't they have to possess her friends and stuff like that?
But anyway. That was only a one special ceremony.
But again, Dax and Trill.
You know.
Yeah, Dax was a Trill, and Adira's a human. But the other members of the council come down to catch them and find out what they're doing, and then Adira starts having a reaction like she's not, I don't know, she's not taking to the connection very well. So they let Michael go in there after them, after her. And that's where I'm kind of like, I understand Michael's the main character of this show, and I love Michael Burnham. I think she's a great character. But does she have to save everybody every single time?
She's a responsibility hoarder.
Yeah.
Well, and in this case, there was literally no, like, she was, that's what she was there to do.
The room is full of Trills that could have
who
gone in there and done that.
Ass about Adira.
Well,
right.
One of them.
They don't. And there's no reason that Adira would trust them.
But Adira,
she barely trusts Michael.
Michael doesn't know any more about this communion than Adira does, but then she goes, when she gets in there, she tells her how to connect with them and like leads her through it. And I would have enjoyed it more if they had just let Adira just do this on her own, you know, and let her have this, have these scenes, but it's the fact that it's a brand new character and they don't want to spend that much time away from their established character, so they got to stick one of them in there with her.
Well, also, Michael has been through the I don't buy this, but I need to learn to acquiesce to it for it to work over the last two seasons. And Adira is 16 years old. And we saw over the course of the episode, granted, again, we're talking, as Tom points out, it's a much more abbreviated timeline.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody in that room was anywhere near as trusted by Adira as Burnham is. And so, and that's what, you know, we didn't have two or three episodes to establish. You got to let me go. No, you can't go, but you're human. But I've got to get there. She's not going to, they had to condense it. You know, we have, whether we like it or not, we've got 10 episodes to get through this storyline. So we've got to accept certain shortcuts. And I think a big shortcut in this episode was, no, Burnham wouldn't be the obvious choice other than the fact that Burnham's the only one in that room that Adira would trust. You know, when Burnham got in the water, I was like, okay, fine. And then she laid on her back and her eyes turned white. I'm like,
She just immediately goes into it, yeah.
I was supposed to go in there and help someone in the water. I'd be diving down to the bottom of the damn pool.
Well, she did. She tried.
Well, when she got in there, she said, where is she? I can't find her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brandon's like, yeah, I viewed it as that's kind of risky. Let's send the human.
Right.
Well, I think it is an emotional and psychological and physiological response, and your level of emotion. I mean, they literally show that your level of emotion affects the outcome of the procedure, and yeah, she doesn't even fully trust Michael, but she trusts Michael a hell of a lot more than just anybody else there.
Tried to kill her yet.
Yeah. Well, the gist of what she learns when she's in there is that she gets her memory back first. So her boyfriend was originally the one that got connected to Tall. And she was there. Yeah, she was there with him. Afterwards, the ship they were on got hit by an asteroid, or they hit the asteroid. Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, an asteroid hit the ship.
Whether the rock hits the pitcher or the pitcher hits the rock, it's going to be bad for the pitcher.
An unstoppable force meets an immovable object, you know.
Well, and also, like, you know, what happened to S.H.I.E.L.D.? Like, I'm fine without an explanation on...
No alarms. There was no alarms or anything. It was just, oh.
I mean, I'm fine with it. It's good drama, and I don't, you know, for whatever... If I can headcanon it with a simple sentence that doesn't upset anything, I'm fine with it.
But Gray, which was her boyfriend's name, dies. But before he dies, the drones that are on the ship are able to transplant the symbiote from him to her. And it takes, I don't know how many times throughout the 900 years a symbiote might have been put into a human, but the only time that we've ever seen it was in The Next Generation, and it didn't work. It almost killed Riker. You know, so the fact that it connected with her and it took and it didn't kill her, it didn't even make her sick, you know. Yeah, Brandon says, where was the deflector array? Yeah.
The only thing that shows is, you know, again, when you're dealing with a data set of one, the only thing that the TNG episode showed was that Riker cannot tolerate Odon.
Right. True.
Mm. And also, if the joining is about each one accepting the other, keep in mind, the latest host, the freshest memories are from the person that loves her. So it's not that surprising that they have an immediate connection, or at least enough to... You know, for Gray to convince the others that she's not so bad, and let's try it out.
Yeah, and then so she meets all the other people that have been hosts to her symbiont, and Senatal is one of them, and he's there, and he says that, you know, Tall accepted all of us, and even though it's unusual for a human to be joined, Tall accepts you too, you know, so. Which, I mean, I think she already knew that Tall accepted her, She just couldn't really communicate with Tall because they didn't have a psychic connection the way a Trill would
she
have.
Did she even know before Sarut and the sphere data told her that the slug, the squid, was like a fully sentient memory carrying creature? Or like, because she didn't remember how it happened.
Well, yeah, because she knows who her boyfriend Gray was. She just didn't remember. The joining, so she would have known who what a Trill is and how all that works because she had been involved in his joining and all that kind of stuff. So.
I'm going to disagree with you, Sean.
Okay.
I don't think Adira. They even said that Adira didn't know anything. Not just forgot the joining. She didn't know anything of her life prior to waking up on that escape pod, and she was already joined. But she did say that, you know, she did research. So, you know, they had records of what the Trill were. And so I'm assuming that when she was recovered in that escape pod, someone scanned her, hey, you've got a symbiote inside you. Oh, okay, what the heck? It's Trill, so I'm going to read about it and find out. So, but she didn't know anything about Gray, didn't know anything about the rest of the background. At least that's what I interpreted her lines of, you know, about her memory loss.
Well,
which is, now that you mention it, that is weird. Because even if you didn't remember, even if you got like, I mean, I assumed that it was a traumatic block, which is why she couldn't remember.
Not convenient memory loss is what I'm calling it. She forgot what she needed to forget in order for us to tell the story we needed to tell in this episode.
She knew enough to know that she knew that her symbiote had been joined to Senatal because that's how all this came about in the first place was her telling.
Right. Well, what I was going to say, it's weird that she. So she wakes up, hey, you got a Trill inside you. What the heck's a Trill? She does the research, whatever. It's weird that there wouldn't be, I mean, unless everybody died on that ship except for her and all the records were destroyed, there would be some, she should be able to CSI it and figure out, okay, this person had a Trill, now I've got a Trill, and this person's dead, so I've got his Trill. What's the relationship between me and this other person? Like, they should, like, yes, it's plot convenience, and I'm letting it go, and clearly it didn't really bother me because I didn't think about it until just now. But it is weird that, like, you know, just level one detective sleuthing couldn't figure out that, like, she got the Trill from Gray and she was in a relationship with Gray. But
well, she's 16.
I'm okay with it.
Her ship was destroyed. She woke up in an escape pod. How many 16-year-olds do you know are all that good at figuring stuff out?
Enough. Look.
Well, obviously.
Yeah, I was gonna let it go, Rick, but since you,
she may not be able to communicate with Tall herself, but Tall is obviously affecting her in some way because Stamets and Tilly are talking about it. She's so smart. She's as smart as I think Tilly says that she's like a really old starship or something like that.
I'm saying beyond whatever memory connection you're making with the Trill. Just if you can do the level of research, like you find out what a Trill is, you can do a level of research to find out what happened to your ship. You can do a level of research to find out how did I get on the ship, who was I with on the ship, unless all those records are destroyed. And that might be. We don't know really what happened to. And we're assuming it's a ship, right? Did we even see it or not a space station or something?
No. I think it was. Didn't they say it was like a colony ship or something?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it was a generational ship.
Yeah, that brought up something that I wanted to ask because they said that that Senatal had been on a ship. Okay, let's back up. The message had come 12 years previous, and then Senatal died on some ship. They didn't know where it was headed. Then they, in this episode, it's a generation ship that the Tall symbiont at least was on. Don't know if, well, Senatol must have been on because they were there, they showed the surgery. So, you know, what
my, did this, go ahead. I took that to mean that Senatol was in communication with the Federation and he was going to the secret location or coming back from the secret location of the Federation. And on his way back, he had whatever caused him to die. And his symbiont was transferred to Gray. That's how I took that. I took that as kind of a, not a chance encounter, but, you know, we can't warp anymore. This is the closest ship with a trail on it. Do you accept, you know, pass this test, you know, check the box, multiple, you know.
Yeah.
Well, remember, without warp drive, planets are hundreds, assuming that Impulse can get up to, let's say, 0.9C, planets are still hundreds of years apart, if not millions. So, and they've also pretty much indicated that subspace communications are shot too.
Mm-hmm. My understanding was Senatol was coming back from the hidden location of the Federation. So he knows where it is. Nobody else does. Something happened to him. He needs to transfer to the closest trail, which is Gray. And something happens to Gray, and he needs to transfer to the closest person who can take a trill, which is
She was obviously, I guess, the only person
in the room.
Yeah,
like the closest person who could take a trill, like immediately.
And as for deflectors and stuff, again, if warp reactors no longer work, then things like deflector shields and stuff like that may be less efficient or non-existent. And so that's where you get an asteroid smashing into the ship.
Especially if it's a generation ship, like by definition, it's old and things don't work and, you know, it's patched together and maybe they diverted power from this alarm or that sensor to keep life support going.
You know, it would be like if we all of a sudden had to, if all gasoline in, on Earth suddenly stopped working, there would be a small handful of people who could sail. But for the most part, every vehicle on Earth would be useless or would become incredibly primitive.
Flintstone cars, We'll still be able to go down a hill really fast. But, okay, so Adira now can access the memories of her former hosts. But she does have a side effect because apparently Gray is back in the form of a hologram that only she can see in here. And I don't know.
I lost herself weeping from episode to episode.
Yeah. So they're going to have some issues later on that Gray is kind of following her around and I don't know, saying things to her and stuff.
This is not unprecedented in Star Trek. Go back to Gul Dukat with his hallucinations.
Mm-hmm. Or O'Brien in Hard Time.
Yeah. Yeah. So
like one of my favorite episodes. But
one with the little girl in Next Gen.
Oh, Dark Page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
An episode I didn't like until after I became a parent, and then I was like,
"You think he's an hallucination?"
No, not exactly.
I think it's an internal psychic connection. I think that the memories of that host are manifesting as I don't know what a figment.
Yeah, because she had a connection to that person before, and now she's essentially a part of that person because they both had the same symbiote. Even though Gray only had the symbiote for, a couple days, I guess. It was very recent.
But they actually said, "How can you be here?" And he's like, "I don't know."
Language.
Damn it, sorry.
And I like when you get called out on language, Rick, you swear again.
I know. I'm so bad.
Language. Yeah,
you're the worst. I mean.
Damn it, he knows.
There's
something we haven't talked about yet about this episode that I really want to make sure we do because Wilson Cruz shone in this episode. This was his episode as much as anyone else's.
Yeah.
And last, you know, for the first two seasons, he was there, and then he became the MacGuffin. But in this episode, I know he's not the CMO of the ship, but he was incredible in this episode.
Wilson Cruz
and I
is
so love watching him.
One of those actors that he's been underused on Discovery so far, because
oh hell yeah,
I've known him. I've known him like I'm friends with Wilson Cruz or whatever. I've known of him since I was a teenager, because he was a main character on That So-Called Life, which was a pretty big deal, you know, when I was growing up, and he was great on that show. But he was a kid himself, because Wilson Cruz and I are probably about the same age. So,
by the way, that's Culber, folks. If you don't know who I'm talking, if you're not familiar with the names, that's Culber.
He was a kid himself, and then I would see him in random stuff here and there, and then when I found out he was on Discovery, oh, he's great, and then they put him on there, and he's great on the show, but they don't use him enough, and they don't. You know, they don't do enough with him. And when he died in the first season, I was like, I can't believe they killed him. You know, then they, you know, they did the thing that they did to him and all that. But yeah, he was good in this episode. And I hope that they keep doing stuff with him for sure.
Yeah, I think I posted that this is my new favorite episode. I mean, obviously, we're only up. We just started the season. But this is my favorite episode of the season so far. And I was saying that It's like, I was like, oh, I really like this episode. And then they would do something else that made me really love the episode. And then they would do something else that made me really love the episode. And, you know, they started doing haiku at the dinner table. I'm like, well, fuck.
Yeah.
I feel so mean.
I did think of you when
I
that,
thought of you too.
When that happened.
And that scene at the dinner table with all the poetry is, that was a scene where I was never so glad to be wrong, in that it became clear once they had Kayla start to do a poem that it was not some remnant of control. It was not some alien influence that was causing her to act the way she was in previous episodes. It was just, you know, everything that had happened and the effect it was having emotionally. So it was something as simple as PTSD, and I was really glad that it wasn't something more nefarious. And they pulled it off in that scene so well.
Well, yeah, but when she started doing a poem about Stamets' blood and how red it was, I was like, man, I mean, I understand you're stressed out, but you are dark.
Well, she said two ships blown out from underneath
until,
her.
Until he called them out and said, you guys are both acting like assholes. It's like, yeah, you're right, they are.
The
thing to keep in mind about Kayla and with her trying to make a poem, that was not her just deciding, you know what, I'm going to be mean because I'm in a bad mood and I'm gonna let loose. To steal a line from a season two episode of The West Wing, I don't think she was fully conscious when she was saying it.
No.
That was not her just deciding to let loose and be mean. That was her having an episode.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it was so uncomfortable to watch, which made that scene so good.
That whole scene was so organic. You know, when I watched it the first time and everything just kind of fell apart and went to hell, I didn't see it coming. You know, I've seen plenty of scenes like that where it's like, this is just wrong from the get-go. But it felt so, I was so with Saru at the beginning of that scene because it felt right. And it wasn't, he wasn't being patronizing. He wasn't being foolishly naive. It really, everybody in that room
was trying their hardest.
Was trying, yeah, exactly. It wasn't one of those, oh shit, we gotta behave ourselves, and then it just all falls apart. It organically fell apart. in a way that felt natural and real. And one of the things I loved, did any of y'all watch the Ready Room for this episode?
I did.
No, I managed to see it.
The Wilson Cruz thing?
Will Wheaton had Rapp and Cruz on, and Stamets Will and asked him, Stamets and Culber, yeah. He asked Cruz, Culber, if that scene where he, that moment where he did the, tried to do the haiku and then didn't get it right, and he's like, oh, I f***ed it up, sorry. And it seemed like an improv moment because it felt really real. And he's like, no, that's how it was written. And Wheaton was just like, I bow down to your amazing acting. And I thought the same thing. It felt like one of those moments where it was just like, okay, riff on this and we'll go with it. But no, that was a choice by the actor. That was his acting ability to make that seem so real. And he said that he came at it as Culber purposely screwed up to give everyone else permission to be imperfect.
I like it even better now.
Yeah, it was just beautiful.
It definitely showed one of the most distinct differences between modern Trek versus I'm gonna try this and see if it sticks. We'll call it Silver Age Trek, which is 87 to Enterprise finale.
05.
Sure, why not?
Whereas 05, thank you. 87 to 05, we'll call that Silver Age. And the difference between modern and Silver Age is a naturalistic performance is the norm now. Whereas it was very rare in Silver Age Trek. TNG, Starship Mine, they're on Arcuria base. Data is trying out his new small talk subroutine, and he's testing it he's testing it with Riker and someone else, and Crusher, and he says when he says something particularly funny, and Frakes broke, and they kept that in the scene. Same thing with Future Imperfect at Riker's birthday party. He blows out the candles, and Marina and Troy ask him what he wished for, and he doesn't say anything, and you see Marina elbow Frakes in the side. That's real, because he forgot the line. He elbows him, he starts to laugh, and then he gives the line, and then everyone cracks up laughing, and if you watch, you can tell that's a blooper, and they kept it in there because it was so natural. And that's something that you didn't see very much back then, was a natural performance. These days, that's just how they do it. To know that Wilson performed it the way he did, not only to purposely make it so natural, but with a purpose. So it was intentionally unintentional on purpose. That makes it outstanding.
We have to talk about one more thing before we finish, and Zora has returned.
I was not going to let this out. I would have brought it up too. I can't let this go without talking about that.
Yeah. So, so Saru is trying to come up with some ideas to give his crew some stress relief. And all of a sudden, the computer kind of glitches and kind of giggles. And then after that, basically Zora. She never says, hi, my name is Zora.
She's flipping back and forth. But
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Saru, to his credit, he's just kind of like, okay. if this is what's happening, I did like when he said, a computer, run a diagnostic.
A level 10 diagnostic, which we've never heard before.
A level 10 diagnostic? Did he just make that up? Is it just him exaggerating for the computer's sake?
Check every circuit 15 times. Yeah. Go.
Level 11, that is something different.
Well, yeah. I mean, if their computer goes bad,
you see what you did, Rick? You opened up the gates, now John's just throwing out the F-bomb.
I think that Saru, even when it was happening, he realized that it probably had something to do with that sphere data that was...
He's a scientist. I'm sure he figured it out.
That was in... because that's a lot of data to put into, That's a whole lot of brain to shove into Discovery's tiny little head at one time.
It seems like without really making it clear and obvious to us, as deliberate is the word I was looking for, without making it terribly deliberate, they've essentially incorporated the sphere data into the main computer, and it's all one. Whereas the sphere data used to be its own thing that they would have to search through and research separately. But now it seems like they're already aware of it. They can just ask the computer, hey, search this thing. And now we know that you have way more information than you had, last year.
Well, yeah. You certainly can't expect them to turn their backs on their lives, their families, go almost 1,000 years into the future and go, no, we can't use this information.
it makes a lot of sense, and I'm glad they did it. It would have been more awkward, and it would have been harder to understand if they kept the sphere data distinctly separate.
Yeah.
And they had to, you know, go consult that individually.
What else?
Right.
Like Archer with Daniel's, future history thing.
It also bridges those gaps that you might get story-wise later on, where you have a 23rd century crew that is now well past everything that we saw in Next Gen, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and all that. For them not to be able to ever look back and see, oh, they did this at this time, and it was something that happened on Deep Space Nine or whatever. That would eventually, us as fans would start to look at that kind of sideways. They could look back and they can see where they figured this out already.
The sphere may not have known events, but it knows who all the players are.
It knows who all the aliens are and their histories and things like that. It will be interesting going forward. If Zora becomes like a character on the show, like the computer is a character, because they had a series of Star Trek novels, they had the New Frontier novels, and there was
I was just thinking that.
Yeah, there was a character on that I think she died and they had to, but they were able to download her essence into the computer, and so the computer basically became her, and so the ship was a character in the story, in all the stories and stuff. So,
well, and also this gives us a good out, because and we've done it on this show. We're like, are we now going into the time that the short trek was in, or is the crew are we expecting Discovery to go back in time and be lost for 1,000 years and then the crew are going to find? No, I mean that could still happen. But now that Zora is becoming sentient now, it could very easily be 50 years between now and when Discovery is abandoned, and then Zora sits for 1,000 years before Kraft finds her. So we aren't necessarily locked into any sort of timeline that the short trek with Kraft and Zora established.
Yeah, but at least we know that story is something that happened. It's not like a possible future. It did happen, or it will happen, because
the Calypso.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I assume that all short treks, I mean, with the possible exception of the
cartoon.
Actually, no, I'll bring that in too.
Yeah, but you're not one of the fans that tries to disregard everything that you don't like.
I guess not. I mean, I consider Lower Decks just as much canon as, anything else. It's just, I've got more of a one-night stand relationship with canon anyway than, like, this, than the slavish devotion of others. So
I think that Calypso still ranks as my favorite short trek. So the fact that one of the only two characters to appear in that short trek is beginning to appear in Discovery makes me very, very happy. I'm very excited. I do believe that Zora will continue to evolve and become more of a character. And you all know me and you know how I operate. I could come up with at least three different theories on how we can get from where we are now to where we're in Calypso and how that would roll into this season and become part of the story. I could come up with a couple different ways to do it, but I'm trying to be nice. Only three. But rather than put forth those theories, I'll just say that I'm really excited to figure out which one they go with. Because now we know she's going to become Zora. Kraft will be a factor. Is that somewhere in the future, or is that destined to become part of this season? I don't know. And finding that out, at this moment, that is what I'm most excited about for this season, is the possibility of seeing how Calypso works into the series overall. Second thing, my second most excited aspect is to see these new 33rd century Starfleet uniforms, because they look like the closest marriage between the Maroon Monsters from movies 2 through 6 and the primarily gray and black uniforms from post-Nemesis or post-First Contact.
All right, Rick, final thoughts, and let everybody know where they can find you.
Did anyone catch that one of Tal's former hosts was a Picard era Starfleet officer?
Yes, I did.
Captain?
Ooh.
Yep.
Which one?
I don't remember what they didn't say who the names were, but there was a tall African American. Well, maybe I'm assuming
it was a tall black gentleman. He was on the right side of the line as we're facing the hosts.
But he was wearing captain's pips in a Picard era uniform.
Yep.
Oh, so that we means may be seeing
Tall is a very, very old symbiont, if that's true.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
You said how many? Seven?
Retro uniforms.
Previous hosts? How many previous hosts?
I think we saw like 6 or 7 in that lineup, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's all of them. That's just who showed up for the party.
Yeah.
and also,
that's true.
I just want to give mad props to, you know, Jonathan Frakes, of course, when he directs an episode, it's going to be amazing. But Hanalei Culpepper, some of the best episodes of this show have been hers. And this was, Forget Me Not was her, and just incredible. Did anyone else bawl their eyes out during this episode? Because I must have cried like 3 or 4, and my wife did. My wife, in a lot of ways, our gender roles are reversed in my marriage in a lot of things. I'm the one that bawls when we're watching TV shows, and my wife's like, what's wrong with you?
She's the one that changes the oil.
No, I do all of that. No, I do all that.
I don't normally cry, but I'm soulless. I
cried a lot during this episode, and so did she. We were both sitting there sniffling.
But it was after being accepted by the previous hosts and by the symbiont, and all the other hosts left and Gray stayed behind and they said goodbye before Gray turned around and walked away. That was the moment that got me.
Mm-hmm. All right, Rick, let everybody know where they can find you.
Nowhere. I don't exist right now. No. Okay. For about another month, depending on when this is coming out fairly soon. So tomorrow, in November, you can go to starbasecommand.net, but very soon that's going to be disappearing. And after January 1st, things are going to be very different.
Yeah.
But also the same.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
The higher, the fewer.
Exactly.
Tom, thanks for joining us. You got anything you want to add before we close out?
I've just been really enjoying this season. I'm hoping we don't see any Klingons, because that's been I just hated the Klingons in the last two seasons.
It seems like Discovery is making the rounds to you know, they went to Earth one episode, they went to Trill one episode. Next week they'll go to, well, they're going to the Federation. Then we'll go to Vulcan. Then we'll go to Ron. You know,
Vulcans are going to be the big bad in this this series.
Could be.
That would be cool. No, I think that that pad that had the message, the location of the Federation, right at the end of the episode, it's going to be like the scroll of the Dragon Warrior in Kung Fu Panda. You know, the Federation is in you. It's in your heart. So.
Mad Pops, a Kung Fu Panda reference.
Thank you.
All right, Scott.
Let's see. Are we doing final thoughts or where can you find us? And both. And Tom, yeah. can we find you anywhere yet?
Not yet at the moment since editing isn't done, but hopefully once editing's done and then talk to Sean, I've been trying to put together a very short, brief podcast on the series Upload.
Oh, okay. So, cool.
That's hopefully will be coming to your podcast players near you.
All right.
So episode one has been recorded, and like I said, I'm just finishing up the editing and interstitials on that.
Okay. Final thoughts. I thought these episodes were great. Forget Me Not, I thought was the better of the two. It's setting up a lot of good stuff to explore and get into. I'm also so far really appreciating the fact that we've been given a mystery for the season, and that is, what was the burn? What made it happen? And how? What was the burnum? The dilithium is gone. When does all the pork go as well? So we know that that happened. We have to solve that mystery. And how are we going to rebuild the Federation? But there's no looming threat like the Klingons or like Control or artificial intelligence Cthulhu. We don't have any of that hovering over us. It's just, how did this happen and where do we go from here? That's the main mystery and question of the season, and I'm enjoying that. So I'm really excited to see where it goes from there and to see these characters develop and to see the new comm badges introduced. That's going to be fun. I'm waiting for that, because once they introduce them, they'll probably be for sale somewhere on the internet, and then I'll get one. You can find me various places here on the Cosmic Potato Network, including the flagship show, Super Fan Talk Podcast. You can find me sometimes on Captain Game Show, on this show right here, that Star Trek podcast, and also on my very own show, The Prime Direction, which is still mine for a little while longer, and another episode will be coming fairly soon. If you're tired of listening to me and you'd rather see some of the visual stuff I do, you can check out my graphic artwork that I do freelance by contract. You can find that on Twitter at Planet Rise, or visit my website, www.planetrisecreative.com. Anyone who likes any of that work that I do, keep an eye on the Twitter account, because this year's Star Trek Advent calendar will be starting in just a couple weeks.
All right, John, what about you?
You can find me on Captain Game Show. It is the trivia wordplay podcast of the network you're currently listening to. You can also find me on other shows on this network where you can find me.
All right. That's going to do it for us this week. Thank you all for listening. We'll be returning next week to talk about episode 6, which is titled Die Trying. Until then, remember, cake is eternal.
Cake is eternal.
Cake is eternal.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of That Star Trek Podcast. You can contact us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can send us an email at thatstartrekpodcast@gmail.com. Help the show grow by giving us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcatcher. This program is not affiliated with CBS or Paramount Pictures. No infringement of copyrighted material is intended. Be sure to join us again next time on That Star Trek Podcast, right here at CosmicPotatoNetwork.com.